Okay, so this is joint work with Ronald de Wolf, which appeared in ICALP in 2004. And I'm afraid it will include somewhat larger amounts of quantumness than we had so far. So for the people who are here this morning, I want to apologize. I quickly want to tell you again what locally decodable codes are and what we know about them. And then I want to explain how we can get a new lower bound, especially if the answers are longer, which someone was asking about this morning. And the crucial point there is a new quantum trick, which might even be of independent interest if someone has that. Okay, and then I briefly want to talk about private information retrieval and how our tool can apply there. Okay, so I mean, you all know about this. The point of a locally decodable code is I have some input string of n bits, and I want to find some encoding such that even if I have a few errors, I can query just a few positions. And especially, I will be interested in where we just want to read two elements of this code graph, such that I can compute some function of these two elements, which will tell me some bit xi that I'm interested in. And I mean, as Ronald and a few other people already mentioned this morning, the main advantage is here that we don't need to read everything. We can just restrict ourselves to a few entries. Okay. So more formally, Ronald already told you that locally decodable code is generally some encoding from some n-bit long strings to some n-bit long code, which is parameterized by a few parameters, so we are allowed to make q queries to this code, meaning that we can make q positions. And we have some epsilon, which will determine how well we can decode, and we have some delta, which determines what kind of errors we can actually still tolerate. And this code is called locally decodable if there exists some randomized decoding algorithm such that for some n-bit long code, which might be a bit corrupted, we must can make at most q queries to it in a non-adaptive fashion. And if, in fact, this corrupted code is not too far from a real one, then we can still decode it with some probability depending here on this epsilon. So generally, you want, as Ronald said, epsilon to be a half for perfect decoding. And just to remind you, the relevant question here is how long does that code word have to be? So we're trying to find some bound on the n here. Okay. So Ronald mentioned it this morning, just for people maybe who weren't there, to compare this to a normal error correcting code, there you read everything, meaning that you make just as many queries as your code word is actually there. Now, if you make a quite large, like one logarithmic amount of queries, then there exists encodings which make actually which are not too big in terms of the length of the original string. But like I said, we're really interested in making just a few queries, in particular maybe a constant amount of queries. And here the length of the code word is actually pretty large. It's exponential in the size of the original input string. So what are the lower bounds? Ronald already mentioned that if we just read one element of the code word, then we cannot construct any locally decodable codes. And Katz and Trevisan had already found some lower bounds on this end, which were improved by Karinidis and de Wolf. And in particular, in this talk, I will be interested in finding new lower bounds if we read exactly two positions in the code word. And what is different now from the talk that you saw this morning is that we now deal with, say, longer answers, so each entry of this code word is much longer. And in fact, especially in the PR setting, where we'll make an example later, it will turn out that our bounds are actually interesting if we just want to learn a few bits from each answer. So we read a code word, which might be quite large, but we again use just a few bits. Okay. So let me just tell you what was known so far. Ronald has not mentioned it this morning, but in fact, their result implied that the lower bound on the size of the code word, which is exponential in the size of the original string, in this particular function. And here we improve it slightly by turning this 5 here. So L here is the L bit of the answers, like the entries of the code word. We improve this slightly from a 5 to a 2. But I mean, you can see that if these entries, each entry is pretty large, So if L is something like log n over 2, then this is not a very interesting lower bound. So in particular here we're interested in if these entries can be much longer, but we just use a few bits. And it might may seem obscure at this point why we're interested in this, but in fact in some private information retrieval schemes have exactly that form. So both of Schumann and Trainson have shown the following results for linear log-n decoding codes. And we can here show with using quantum tricks something similar for all log-n decoding codes. And in fact here we just gain an extra factor of 2 to the b, where b determines the number of bits that we use from each answer. An example for a PIR scheme where the answers are actually quite long, which would correspond to the. So, I mean, we can take every PIR scheme and turn it into a locally decoded code. And so, from this PIR scheme, you could, in fact, make a locally decodable code where the answer sets are, like, each code word entry is very long, then you square root n, but you, in fact, use only one bit from that answer. So, I'll make that example later. So the proof is actually very, very similar to what you saw this morning. So we take two classical queries. Say we query two positions in this code word. And the new trick here is now that we have a new quantum tool that I will explain in a second that allows you to deal with longer answers. And then again, we'll combine two queries to get a quantum random access code. So let's just recap. So a classical decoder would pick two code word positions, say Q0 determines the first position of the code word 11-3, Q1 determines the second one. But from each of these answers I get, I just want to have use B bits in my decoding procedure. And S0 is going to determine which of these bits we want. So S0 is just a set of size B, which lists all the indices we're interested in. And similarly, S1 is a set of B elements which determines which entries of the answer to the second query we're going to use. And also in the classical code, I have some function f which determines then what I actually do with these remaining bits in order to get xi, the bit that I want to decode. Okay. Now, Roland has already told you this morning how you can vary elements in superposition. Now for the non-quantum people, I really don't want to go into too much detail in this, but the point I want to make here is that I can choose some encoding of some sort, such that if I query some element of the code, so Q here tells me which element I want to read, that I can get also in the phase here, I can get the inner product between some string T that was part of my input here, and AQ. So AQ is the position of the code word at the element of the code word at position Q. And so maybe you have some idea where this is going. This T here will allow me to specify which elements of the answer I want to use. So then this inner product here will sort of pick out the entries of the answer which are actually relevant to my decoding procedure. Okay. This may look intimidating, but this is not really the intention. So we can put two queries in superposition, as Ronald has shown you. So this determines the first position I want to read. This determines the second one I want to read. And just as I showed you in the previous slide, we can ask these two questions or queries in superposition. And we'll get as an answer, here in the phase, something which depends on the entries that we wanted to query. the superposition, and for the quantum people this might become clear in a second, for the other people I just want to give you some addition. This is just a superposition of sets T, which are subsets of this size S0. So this had determined which of the bits are not. So clearly it's clear that this inner product here, I can, instead of just having a zero here, I can just restrict it to S0. Because T is a subset of S0, so by removing these entries, I won't change anything. Now, for the non-quantum people, this might not be clear. But there exists, in fact, a transformation that we can perform on the second part, which will map this whole unwieldy looking thing into a superposition of these queries, where we have here the answers to our two questions. And in fact, I mean, instead of writing Q0 and Q1 here, let's just, we can transform this to just having 0 and 1. So just the first question, second one. Okay. So now but remember that the algorithm computed some function of this answer bit in order to determine what x r is. So from this funny state here, now we want to compute a function of f of a restricted to the set S0 and a1 restricted to the set a1. And I think this was exactly the question someone had asked this morning, whether it's possible to do this. And I'm going to show now some new quantum tool which allows us to do exactly that. So in general, I've now left out this S0 in this instrument to make it easier to read. Suppose we are given exactly one copy of such a state, where these are b-bit long strings. The question is, how well can we compute some function, any function, of these two b-bit long strings? And we provide some general strategy where we can, which shows you how to compute any function with some probability depending on the length of these strings. And in fact, we also show that our strategy is optimal if f is just the parity of all the bits. Okay. Now, as Yordanisat explained this morning, all transformations on quantum states are described by unitary transformations. And so one of the tools here will become clear on the next slide why we want to do such a thing, is that we show how to, that there exists a unitary transformation, which has input taken one of these strings, and some just ancilla zero, maps this to a superposition of b-bit long strings, and some extra job which we just need to make this unitary. And the intuition behind here is that now here in the superposition we have sort of evaluated f for all possible inputs of A0. We fix this input and we evaluate it sort of simultaneously on all of the first possible inputs. Okay. So now how can we use this? So we start out with this state. We just add this little extra qubit that our unitary needs. And now we apply the following transformation. Now, for the non-quantum people, the only important thing to remember about this funny-looking transformation is it has the effect that if the first bit is a zero, I just apply the identity to the rest. And if the first bit is a one, then I will apply this unitary that we just constructed. So suppose now we apply this transformation. So maybe for the quantum people I should say that actually I didn't use this to denote the tensor product. So what happens if we apply this transformation to the state? So here we have a zero. So it means we just don't do anything to this part, we leave it intact. But here we have a one. So then we applied this unitary that we constructed earlier, which here gave us the superpositions of all b-bit long strings. So now why is this useful? I'll just abbreviate this a little bit. Let's just call this gamma, and let's say we call this part delta. Then just consider for now, what would be the inner product? So remember that these are just vectors between these two vectors. And it turns out that this inner product, in fact, depends exactly of the function evaluated at a0 and a1, which is what we wanted to learn somehow. So for the non-quantum people, the intuition is the following. If I sort of take this part and glue it together to this one here, what happens is that I just pick out the j, which is equal to a0. And with the other j's, I will have 0 in the product. So in fact, what's left is just, say, 1 over 2 to the b, which comes from here, and minus 1 to the f, no, just with the a0, because everything else goes away. Okay, so this progress, I mean, you already have something now which actually depends on what we want. Okay. So I've just rewritten this now because it makes it a bit easier to read and with these symbols that I just introduced. Now, I don't remember actually whether Jordanis said this morning introduced the Hadamard transform. But what this does, it just makes 0 plus 1, and it gets 1 to 0 minus 1. Okay. Now, apply this transformation to the 0 here, and also to the 1, and then some simple rewriting gives you exactly that. Now what we want to do is we measure the first qubit. So we look at this and see whether it's in 0. And it turns out, I'm not going to write this out now, but it turns out now if you calculate the probability of measuring a 0, this will actually depend on the inner product between gamma and delta. But as I showed you on the previous slide, this inner product depends exactly on this function of evaluated at position a 0. So basically, by performing these procedures, we have evaluated f at a0 and a1 with some bias away from half. So we can do that a few times. Okay. Are there some questions about this before I continue? Okay, so everybody's really confused. Which is more likely.
You do this many times, and then eventually you take the average and see where it's about.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, okay, so if this is just for one copy, yeah. So if you're given many copies, then you can do it like on each copy individually.
And that would be like the queries,
in a sense, yeah.
So how would you compute?
Okay. Okay, so let me continue. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So from a single copy of this state, I can, of course, not do it perfectly. I just get some advantage. But if I give you many, many instances, then you can actually learn it pretty well. And this is exactly actually what we're doing.
So you only see 0 or 1 when you're measuring. But
right.
When you measure the system, you have a 0 or 1.
Right.
With some problems. So
yeah. So remember that this was a Boolean function, right? So it's also just 0. Okay. Now I had mentioned that this is optimal for parity, and maybe if you want, the non-quantum people might want to go sleep for this slide, because so this morning Jordanis had explained to you about mixed states. So a mixed state is just a classical mixture of pure quantum states. You can think of it, okay, so with here I've just assumed uniform probability. So I just pick one of these states and I give it to you, and you're trying to tell me, okay, so what is the XOR of a0 and a1? Now, of course, you're not trying to distinguish all of these states. You're not trying to determine what is a0 and a1. You're just trying to see what is the XOR of these two things. And so in quantum language, this means that you just want to distinguish the state of zero, which is say a mixture of all the states that would give you a zero outcome, from the state where one, which is just a mixture of all the states that would give you a one outcome. And I mean, this is a well-known problem in quantum computing. This is called state discrimination. So we want to tell which of these two states we're given. And it's well known that the optimal probability to do this depends on the trace distance between the zero and one. So I can never do better than this. I think your Dallas has not explained this morning. But for this talk, it's sufficient to see for the non-quantum people that in fact it turns out that in this case, I just get this value 1 over 2 to the b plus 1, which is in fact exactly what our algorithm had achieved.
The last few slides where you said, you know, given these two states, you can distinguish, you can try and guess f of a 0, f of a 1. You gave a specific procedure.
Right.
But is it easy to, you could also just try to, you know, calculate this trace distance sort of more directly. Do you get some? If you don't sort of care to see the procedure, you just want to know that it exists. Is it sort of a simpler argument?
So in general, if you would be given a certain f, say I fix an f, then I can of course look at what is the trace distance between these things. That's correct. But we wanted actually to give a procedure which would work for any f. So in general, maybe you can even evaluate what this trace distance is for any f, but we haven't done that.
So the procedure gives a lower value.
Exactly. So the procedure tells you that for all any function f, I can be at least that good. And so by looking at the trace distance of fixed states for parity in particular, you say, okay, so in this particular case, it's in fact optimal. For some functions, you might do much better. In fact, I mean, you might think of the function that just say, what, you know, the first bit of a zero.
So b equals to 1, then you're able to compute the probability 3-4. 1 half plus 1-4.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in English talk, it was more than 3-4. Like, so
the difference is that in my talk, the answer bits were in the face, they were plus or minus, whereas in this part, the answers are extra cubed. So it counts for the difference.
Yeah.
So my job is that, is it possible somehow to improve this probability, even for me?
So it might be possible to improve this for certain functions. Like I just said, we only know that it's optimal for parity. And yeah, I mean, what one says, if I have the just one bit of answer and have it in the face, then it's easy to pull it out. But in general, these might be longer. Right? There might be like 4 or 5 or even more of these. And we didn't want to restrict ourselves to a certain function. I mean, the decoder can use any function he wants. Just wanted to give a lower bound, or he can at least do that one. Okay. So let me just summarize what we've done so far. Is we've taken two classical queries into a quantum query, gotten some answer, and from that we can in fact compute f of this first part and the second part, which gives us xr. Okay. And now in fact the rest of the proof follows along the same lines as one of us explained to you this morning. Basically, intuitively combine many queries to get a random access code. Maybe for the people who are not here this morning, because there's somehow more people here than earlier, a random access code, just to remind you, is just encoding of some n-bit long string x into some quantum state rho x of say k qubits, such that if I give you rho x, you can predict any bit xi from the original string to some probability p. And in fact, NIAC has proven a lower bound on how big does such a state have to be. Namely, the size of this state is just determined by the length of the original string and the probability that I can recover the bit xi. Okay. So I'm afraid this, okay, this will be my last technical quantum slide, I promise. From this, we can again construct a quantum random access count. I don't really want to go into details here. I mean, Ronald already explained to you here this morning. Maybe I will just tell you where this new approach with the longer answers actually differs from the one discussed this morning. So what is this funny looking state here? So here, you can see this that I have a superposition of all possible entries in the compound that I want to create. So if I want to bring this back to a query, I could make some measurement, which leaves me here with a superposition of just two elements. And maybe this still looks familiar. This looks very similar to the answer we had gotten to a query earlier. The only difference here is that here, we have a superposition of all possible sets of size B. So why is this useful? At this point, we have not yet decided which bits we actually want from the answer. From such a state, we want to get any bits, and we want to defer the choice of which bits we really need for this answer for later. So for the intuitively, what we do is, given such a state, we want to project it down on a state which, in superposition, just contains those sets that we're actually interested in. And for in this talk, I just want to say that there exists such a measurement, which sometimes fails, but we still get quite a reasonable probability. But if this projection succeeds, what we're left with is just two of these queries, and the rest here will just be, again, the answer that we got earlier. Let me just say that because we have some failure probability here, and also here, we can take many states, ux, so we really take quite a few of them. In fact, the number that we take here depends on the length of the covert. Have I deleted this? Size of the answers, and also say the distance, say the error that we want to tolerate. But because from this state, by bringing it down to these queries, we can reconstruct any bit xi, we have exactly done what I had in the previous slide, meaning that we have constructed some state, maybe this one, from which we can predict any bit xi with some reasonable probability. So it is in fact a random access count. And then we can say, okay, so this k here must be at least that large. And from that we actually get our result. Are there more questions at this point? Maybe I should go back to the previous slide. Okay. Okay. So, I mean, as you probably all know, locally decodable codes and PRR are very closely related. So it's actually not surprising that the same stuff works here as well. Let me just remind you. In private information retrieval, we have some servers. Each of these servers is given a copy of the n bit long string, which is the database. The servers are not allowed to talk to each other. And if the user wants to retrieve some bit, he's allowed to ask questions to these servers, which will give him some answers from which he can reconstruct this bit xi. And as you're all familiar, the goal of this whole game is to allow the user to learn the bit xi without revealing which of these bits he's actually interested in. Okay. I mean, clearly, if there would be no privacy, the user could just tell the server, okay, give me bit number i, and we would have a very small amount of communication. There's also a trivial way, of course. The server sends everything to the user. The user at his own leisure picks which bit he wants, and clearly the server doesn't learn anything. And the fact, as Ronald has told you this morning, if we just have one server, this is actually all we can do. But it turns out that if there's more than one server who don't communicate, then it's possible to reduce the amount of communication required. And the question here now is, how much communication do we need? Okay. So now I actually want to make this example, which has exactly this property that we used just a few bits. So remember that the database had this n bit long string? So what the squares thing does, it takes this n bit long string, it puts it in the square root and the square root of the square root. So this bit xi that the user is interested in is sitting somewhere in the square, so say in column i2 and in row i1. Now to retrieve this bit, the user chooses a square root n bit string at random, uniformly. And to the first server, he sends the sum, bitwise sum of this random string, and e i1. So this is a string which is 0 everywhere except at this particular position i1. And to the server 2, he just sends the random string. Now what do these servers do? They just take the question that they got and return to the user the inner product row 2 of this question and each of these columns. So the user gets its inner product of this question and each of these columns. Now of course the user did know all along which column he was interested in. So from all these square root n bits, he now picks the one which corresponds to the column that he's actually interested in. And it's easy to see that if he computes the sum of two of these two things, this r here falls out, and what he's left with is just actually the bit xi that he was interested in. So here, I mean, the questions of the user were of size square root n, the answers are of size square root n, so they're actually still pretty large. But the point is here that this is a scheme which has long answers, but we just needed a single bit of that. Just as some motivation of actually some also other schemes which they make a cube out of this have this form that the answers are quite long, but we just use a few bits.
You just send the
database
just the bit you want. If you have one server, just send the entire database just the bit you want.
Yeah, that's also a kind of form, yes, that's But of course, I wanted to make a scheme because actually our lower bound says that if you have two servers and you use only one bit, that in fact this is all you can do. I will say this in a second. Okay. So now, I mean, this looks very similar to the locally decoded calls, obviously, because they're closely related. If we use all the bits of the answers, then the size of the questions must be at least some constant times n divided by 2^5 times the length of the answers. And here we again improve this slightly by going from 2 to 5. But the fact and point is that if we use just a few bits, then again we get something similar, which was obtained by Baldreich, Karloff, Schumann, and Trevisan. But this time for all private information retrieval schemes. However, for the total amount of communication required, we just go from 4 log n to 5 log n, which is. Yeah, which is not a bit depressing. Okay. So I don't really want to go into details of this. I mean, you've seen this before, and in fact, it's exactly the same trick. So this is the classical scenario. In the quantum scenario, these two servers are combined into a single quantum server. The user constructs a quantum query, so which consists of the questions he would have sent to the classical servers. Where he keeps the first qubit to himself, which actually leads to the security of the scheme, as someone mentioned this, I don't remember who it was, but who said that entanglement in fact leads to the security of this combined scheme. And he receives some answers, and after some processing, he again ends up with some stuff in single position, from which he wants to compute some function. So we can use, again, our trick. And otherwise, the approach is exactly the same as in the case of locally decodable codes. Maybe I just want to say that, of course, every quantum state gives rise to a possessive definite matrix of trace 1. This is, in fact, exactly what the quantum state is. So I would suspect that also I mean, if you don't like quantum, I guess you could take this construction, look at it as a positive semidefinite matrix of trace one, and maybe then also use some other tricks than the ones we use here. Okay. To summarize, if we use all bits, which is
so
okay.
Where is the constant 5 coming from?
The constant 5 just comes from the small improvement really that we make here. But here, I mean, here if the constant 5 comes from the total communication, so the T, so the let me just go down. The size of the questions and the answer. And if you work it all out, then just be safe for. Okay, so we do obtain a slight improvement in that case. If we obtain a small number of bits from each answer, we obtain similar bounding gold type for all PRs, and the same for finite information retrieval. But if we fix B to something, then in fact it turns out that you can rewrite it that the total communication is just lower bounded time by some constant times n to the power 1 over b plus 1. So in particular for the square scheme, where just b is just 1, this means that the square scheme is essentially optimal. So if one would want to construct better classical two-server PR schemes, it kind of means that one needs to use more bits from his answer. Yeah, otherwise, I have to say, it's a bit depressing. So the obvious question is, how can we get better bounds? Or maybe find better classical schemes which actually match these bounds.